All right, everybody. Hi, how's it going? I am your host and book ambassador, Zachary Wolf. With me, we have AJ Rowe, one of our younger authors, going to be reading from the Exodus Project. Take it away.
All right. I'm going to read the first chapter of the book just to kind of introduce you to the, genre that it's in and whatnot. It's a steampunk genre novel, so kind of the Victorian era steam-powered sort of a thing. So here we go. Chapter 1. Roy lay on his back in the crow's nest and gazed up at the pulsing stars littering the sky. Instinctively, he began to map out constellations as his father taught him many years ago. Roy was 16 and had attended the flight academy since he was 11. All of it was preparing him for this flight, aboard the Exodus. His first voyage across the sky, Roy was both eager and still somewhat frightened. The Exodus crew consisted of mostly novices like Roy, hot-headed youths seeking adventure, fame, and glory. But when nothing spectacular took place on the first day, many retired to their quarters early with dreams of adventure dancing in their heads. The Exodus, an older model, was assigned rookie engineers to teach them the basics of flight. 200 eager rookies yearned for the adventure to come. However, Exodus's voyage was unlike any other. For the first time, they were sending an airship over the sea. Such an attempt had not been made during the past 200 years when conventional watercraft was the primary mode of transport. It would still be that way to this day if the drought hadn't come. Over the past 10 years, drought and famine had transformed their once thriving land into a vast ocean of sand, drying up all lakes and rivers. Many governments fell to pieces, and factions of sky pirates had arisen, terrorizing the remaining population. Yet the Exodus was equipped to handle them. She was a seven-decked ship with dedicated cargo bays, four powerful engines, and two massive Zeppelin balloons keeping her aloft. The balloons were supplied by 12 main steam cells, enough to keep her airborne for at least 3 weeks, maybe more. However, despite the efficiency of steam, it also included dangers. The cells themselves were as large as a grown man. The inside of a steam cell was also incredibly fragile. Within each cell were innumerable gears, cogs, and pipes, pumping steam through it to the Zeppelin balloons, keeping the Exodus aloft. To keep the cell from falling apart, a thick metal casing enclosed the device, making it bulky and heavy. Aside from her sleek design, she was also plated with the thickest, strongest hull armor just before the departure, and was well stocked with enough mercury rifles to repel hostile invaders. In spite of Exodus's advanced technology, Captain Arthur insisted that all personnel carry a pistol with them at all times. Roy didn't question his judgment. For the fifth time that night, Roy raised his spyglass to his eye and looked around the ship. Everything seemed normal until a silver flash caught his eye. He focused his scope for a better view. At first, he saw nothing until the spinning blades of an insect-like ornithopter came into focus. It was a small craft bearing down on them at high speeds. He wondered if it had come from Celis, the town from which they had just departed. But something was wrong. Its starboard engine was spewing black smoke, and its flying pattern was erratic. Upon closer inspection, Roy noticed their starboard micro-steam cells were damaged, and was funneling steam at a dangerous rate into the engine. If not repaired quickly, the result could be disastrous. Snapping the glass closed, he leaped to the ladder and slid down. He hit the deck running and made his way around the port cell containment. It was the fastest way to the communications control, his intended destination. Starting at Deck 1, he ran past Decks 2, 3, and 4 until he arrived at Deck 5. Each deck consisted of three sections, A, B, and C. The communications grid was located on Section C. He flew down the rows of crew quarters to the farthest section of Deck 5. Flinging open the door, he stepped inside. The communications control room wasn't much, a small desk and wobbly chair with dozens of red, yellow, and green wires strung about. Pushing the chair out of his way, he flipped a few switches, pulled one of the many levers protruding from the mechanism, and heard the device on the deck buzz to life. Raising the microphone to his mouth, he spoke. "Unknown craft, this is the Exodus. Your ship is in danger. Respond." His voice cracked at the last word. He was beginning to tense up as he waited for a response. Nothing. "Unknown craft, respond." He said it louder, although he wasn't sure if that would help much. He received nothing but static back from the ornithopter. Their communication grid must have been damaged. Plan B. Roy switched off the communications channel and returned to the frequency to match that of the bridge. Again, the device whirred to life as it made the connection. "Communications grid to the bridge, respond," he said clearly. A response came within seconds. Bridge here. Roy, is that you? It was Captain Arthur, his voice easily recognizable despite the crackle of the mechanism. Roy here, sir, he responded. I spotted an ornithopter in our tail, bearing down fast. She seems to be damaged, sir, and isn't responding to communications. I suggest we slow down to allow them to catch up. There was a pause. The constant drone of all the engines began to fade, and the wind died down. They had taken his advice and slowed the ship. Roy, get down to cargo bay one, Captain Arthur's voice came through. See to it that our guests arrive safely. Aye, sir. Communications out. Roy closed the channel and made his way down another deck to the cargo bay. The three cargo bays were the only places manned 24/7, besides the bridge. Crewmen strode about, carrying heavy boxes to be sorted. Being the first day of their journey, the cargo had not yet been properly stowed. The docking clamp was being used to move things about. Amidst the mess, Roy spotted Farron Bennett, the one member of the crew, besides the captain, with whom he was acquainted. I understand we're receiving guests, Farron said, without even looking up from his clipboard as Roy approached. Farron was a year older than Roy and a serious-minded person when it came to his work, but he actually seemed to have developed a sense of humor while off-duty, with Roy's help. Farron was assigned as the cargo bay chief for their 5-day voyage, and while he was a competent worker, he was slow. Yeah, Roy replied. The captain asked me to help you clear landing space. Indeed, Farron continued to scribble on his clipboard. He then turned to a small operating desk higher up. Ready the clamp for docking procedures, he instructed. Clear landing dock 3 of all cargo and open the bay doors. The crew responded quickly, clearing out cargo and revealing a series of small circular slots designed to stabilize any craft in the cargo bay if they encountered turbulence. The massive clamp moved into position as the bay doors rose slowly. Roy's brown hair rippled as they were buffeted by the wind. The ornithopter was much closer now, close enough to make out two figures perched at the helm. The first, a taller man adorned with pilot's gear, sat calmly at the wheel. The second, a short figure in a white coat and goggles, strode nervously back and forth behind the pilot. His mouth was moving rapidly, and his arms in angry gestures. The lights on the landing dock lit up the night, and the craft made a beeline for it. The smoke billowing from the engine had thickened, and the engine coughed and sputtered. Her landing struts extended, and the graceful wings folded into the ship. Her hull reflected the red flash of the landing lights as it began to clear the bay doors. The landing clamp extended and latched onto her hull. She was stable. Then, without warning, their engine gave a final cough and blew. A flurry of sparks showered down as it tumbled sideways into the side of the bay door. The landing clamp bent, and its wooden frame splintered as the ornithopter was ripped from its grasp. There was another explosion as its starboard steam cells ruptured, and it fell back out of the bay, tumbling through the night sky. The Exodus lurched from the impact, and piles of insecured cargo came down. The crew scrambled to avoid them. Roy and Farron were both thrown off their feet and hit the deck hard. They looked at each other and locked eyes for a moment. They knew they both had the same idea. They scrambled to their feet and ran over to the small communications array in the back of the bay. Farron opened the channel and Roy snatched up the microphone. He didn't have to say anything before a message came through. What's going on down there? Captain Arthur's voice crackled through the device. The copter's engines just blew, sir, Roy said. She's falling fast, 5 o'clock. The Exodus swung around and her engines roared to life. Roy could see the ornithopter through the bay doors now. At least half of the microsteam cells had ruptured on her starboard side, spewing broken pieces of machinery into the engine. We aren't going fast enough, Farron yelled over the roar of the engines. We won't catch up with them. Grappling hooks, Roy recommended, but Farron shook his head. We have too much forward velocity, he said. They wouldn't get enough range. Roy thought for a while, before saying quietly, I would. Don't be stupid, Farron growled. There's gotta be another option. Roy ignored him and returned the communications array. The channel was still open to the bridge. Captain, I'm going after them, he spoke clearly through the microphone. His pulse intensified. Absolutely not, the captain's voice came, although even through the distorted frequency, he could hear some doubt in his own voice. Captain, it's the only way. There are two people on that craft, and they'll both die without my help. Please, sir. The microphone crackled. The captain had sighed. Under normal circumstances, I would never let you do this. These are hardly normal circumstances. Go, he barked, and don't tell your mother I let you do this. Roy didn't try to suppress his grin. Even in times like this, their stubborn, fearless captain could have a sense of humor. Aye, sir, he closed the channel. Roy took a hold of a clip hanging from the wall and latched it to his belt. A small sign by the reel led 200 feet. I've got 200 feet to reach the falling ship. Any more and the rope will go taut, and I will have failed. A sudden panic ran through him. What if the rope breaks? What if I don't reach it in time? Stupid thoughts. Wait, Farron said, trying to yank him off of the platform extending out the bay doors. You'll die from the impact. If I'm only moving just a little bit faster than the ship, it'll be like walking on air. Roy pushed him back and then turned to face the clouds whipping by. He closed his eyes, held his breath, and jumped. And that was chapter one.
All right. It's an exciting way to start your novel.
Always good to end it on a cliffhanger.
Or start it on a cliffhanger, whatever yeah. It is. So, when did you start working on this project?
I started writing the Exodus project the summer before my freshman year of high school, I believe, and I had finished it up earlier in the school year, and then took it to you guys.
Okay, about how many rounds of editing did this go through from start to finish before it even got to us?
Oh. I looked over it myself a lot of times. I don't remember exactly how many, but there were several revisions and changes in story and filling plot holes that had to be done before I was ready to send it off to a company.
Sure. Editing is highly important.
That is.
Who's your favorite character in your story? Is it the protagonist, or...?
I wouldn't say so. I enjoyed writing about Roy. He's a very hot-headed kid, but I'm more of a fan of Farron, who was introduced in there as well. More of an intellectual, the brains of the group kind of a person.
Great. Do you relate to any of your characters personally? Is there any AJ in the book?
I wouldn't say that much. I felt like the most would probably be Farron, as I had just talked about. He's more of a calmer, collected person, as I, well, hope that I am.
Well, that would explain why he's your favorite character, then.
Yep.
Were there any points while you were writing that you hit, like, a solid brick wall and just didn't know how to progress?
That happened a couple times. I have... This book is only 12 chapters long, and yet I wrote easily about 18 chapters worth of content, because there came a certain point, I don't want to spoil anything, but there came a certain point where I wanted something to happen, and then I wrote about 3 chapters of it, and I realized that I didn't want that to happen, and that happened a few times before I found the right one, so... Mm.
Speaking of those kinds of circumstances, as a writer myself, I've been in the situation where, while writing, I have an idea in my head, and then the actual story kind of just doesn't work out. It seems like the characters take it in a direction away from you, the author. Do you feel that happens? The story has that much of its own life?
It definitely does. especially, like, writing, especially about Roy, who, as mentioned before, a hot-headed, you know, independent guy, is when you want a story to go a certain direction, someone like that, his character, oftentimes wouldn't exactly act the way you want the story to go. He wouldn't be making, you know, that necessarily correct, mm-hmm. You know, thoughtful decision that his character would be making. So sometimes that did call for a revision in story, yeah.
Now, you've worked through this, you're in what year now?
Junior year.
Yep. So you've kind of had the book published for a little while. Have you been working on any other projects that we can expect to see?
I have a lot of ideas. I mean, through school and work, it's been hard to get, you know, just a lot of time to set aside to work on one, but I have a lot of ideas down. It's still going through the initial stages, but I'm hoping to get started on something this summer at the latest.
A separate story or a follow-up? Completely different?
Probably a separate story. I feel like I wrapped things up relatively well in the Exodus project.
All right. Any fun personal life things to tell us about AJ Rogue? Any fun hobbies or, anything that you do when you're not writing?
Well, I mean... Call this a stereotype, but I do enjoy video games, as I always have, to the point where I've gone as far as to get a job in journalism, writing about them, which I enjoy immensely. So that's where a lot of my free time goes, if it's not just playing the games and writing about them. So.
Well, there you go. Can't escape writing.
Nope. My dad's laughing.
Yes. How did you come up with your title, AJ?
If there's one thing I don't like about this book, it's the title, and if I were to do it again, I wouldn't pick this title, because titles of the book are easily the hardest part of the entire book. It's because I can't think of a title and then revolve the book around that title, because, like, you already know why it's called The Exodus Project, because I read the first chapter. It's about a ship called the Exodus. So you figure that out within the first page of the book. But for other things, it's... I would like to put some kind of, like, depth in it that leaves you thinking as you go through the book. Why is it called this? You know, I'm sure you've all read those books that, like, you read the title, and then you get, like, halfway through the book, and you stop, and you think, that's why it's called, you know,
the classic freshman lit conundrum where you overanalyze every single word in the novel.
Yep. That was fun.
Did you have problems naming any of your chapters, too, or were those easier?
Chapters are much easier, because I'm not a fan of, like, you know, like, Oliver Twist kind of chapter names that are, like, a paragraph long. That I'm just, like, a one-word kind of a person that... Like, for example, chapter one is called Rescue. That's it. And they're all one- to two-word things that I feel like just kind of give a very, very brief idea of what's going on in that chapter and something to look forward to it, because I feel like it's important to have some kind of a title. But I'm not a fan of complex ones, so those are much easier to come up with.
Better than numbers, but still pretty simple.
Yeah.
Were you involved with the cover design very heavily, or was that kind of given to you?
I was happy with the cover design. We had, I don't know who did it exactly, but with through the company, they, was it you?
It was her.
Oh, okay, sorry. my bad. She presented a bunch of, you know, ideas and cover concepts, and I found one that I liked. I liked the background. It looked kind of like sandy. Which is why I went with the background. The picture in the middle was different. We had talked about that, switched it up a little bit. Might have done a different border. I don't think we did a different border. But by the end, I was very happy with it. Much better than my first one. Oh, my goodness. That's Microsoft Paint right there.
Pro covers are the way to go.
Always.
Any more questions from the audience? Celia?
So what's in your future?
Whoa.
Where does AJ Rowe go from here?
Or you have some other direction you're going in.
I definitely see myself continuing with journalism. I've loved doing it. I've loved covering what I cover. And I think it'd be awesome to get a degree in it and maybe get another job in a bigger journalism company or something like that and be able to, like, travel to different places and cover events from there. I think it'd be a lot of fun. I would enjoy it a lot. But I definitely do see myself continuing to write. It's been unfortunate, but this past year or so, I have not had much time to be doing much creative writing because of workload and honors classes and all sorts of fun stuff. But especially in my future, I absolutely plan on continuing writing, yes.
Follow your dream.
You've been writing for a number of years now, taken some classes, been in some groups, all kinds of stuff. Do you see yourself more as an outline writer, or do you just free-flow the whole thing as it comes to you?
I cannot do outlines. I cannot stand outlines. At first, I tried to do it, and I'd say, like, you know, okay, chapter one, this is going to happen. Chapter two, this is going to happen. And by the time I was, like, two chapters in, I had completely strayed from the outline, mm-hmm. and it does not work.
because you have those organic characters that you were talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly. They change. They don't want to follow your story a lot of times. It's sort of like I have a basic idea of what I want to do, but from there, there's a big difference of thinking about writing it versus actually writing it, and while you're writing it, you come up with so many different ideas that you hadn't before, and a lot of the times they end up, like, drastically changing the story, so, yeah, I don't do outlines.
Thank you. Did you see yourself creating the title before you created the story?
I usually don't create titles before I create stories. I wait until I'm done with the whole thing before I come up with the title. For example, I believe the file name of this thing in my computer was just Airship Thing. and then I got 12 chapters of it and probably thought I should put a title on it. But
everyone pick up a copy of Airship Thing and came along with the bookstore today.
Yeah, so I can't come up with... I have to wait until I'm done with the book before I come up with the title.
I have the opposite. I'm not a writer. things. But and I've been asked for a number of years, why don't you write something? So I come up with these titles, mm-hmm. and I have a collection of book titles.
No book
book.
But I know why I mentioned it, created the title, because I know what's behind the title and that my whole story is behind the title. So that's why I asked you the question. There is a movie preceding your time called Exodus. It's the name of a ship.
Oh, I did not know that, actually.
That was my question. You did not know that, so we'll end it right there.
It's called randomshipgenerator.com right there for you. I spend a lot of time on those kind of websites.
Words and names are out there. We just we take them and use them, even though they've been used before hundreds of years or decades before.
Mm-hmm. It's not directly related to the book, but I actually have a friend whose name is Cortez, and his mother thought that she invented the name Cortez. So that's the kind of, you can see titles and names of things floating through the ether that even if you think, this is a completely original idea, someone else was probably done.
Yeah, this is true. Chapters have just gotten so old that I could not read it without cringing, so I went back and just wiped them and completely redid them. And
I don't know, but certain references can seem dated within the span of just a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Fortunately, you're writing in a steampunk genre, so things like technology you don't have to keep up to date.
That's true.
Pull out his razor flip phone and.
Yeah.
Well, there's a good lesson for you. If you're working on something, make sure you get it done before it gets outdated.
Yeah.
You have to rewrite the whole thing.
It's true.
Any more audience questions, comments, concerns? No?
No, we're proud of you.
All right.
Thank
way
you.
To go, AJ. Exodus Project. Look for it on graywolfpublishing.com. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.